listening to Wordplay. It's Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock.
Is a nonprofit community network using integrated media technologies to expand the local public sphere and to support participatory democracy, citizen access to media, independent journalism, local cultural and artistic expression, locally owned businesses, social and economic justice, and environmental stewardship. Find out more about Maine online at www.maine.nc.us.
Well, this is Wordplay. My name is Sebastian. I'm back after a couple months away and filling in for Jeff. Today we're just going to read some poems and play some music. And that was Coleman Hawkins. And I'm going to read a set of three poems and mix it up with some music. And these are two friends who were here last year at the Warren Wilson and UNCA campuses, Ross Gay and Patrick Rizal. And they'll be back in town next spring for the second annual WordFest festival. Ross Gay's poem, Two Bikers Embrace on Broad Street. Maybe, since you're something like me, you too would have nearly driven into oncoming traffic for gawking at the clutch between the two men on Broad Street. in front of the hospital, which would not stop, each man's face so deeply buried in the other's neck, these men, not my guests to be messed with, squeezing through that first porous layer of the body into the heat beneath. Maybe you, too, would have nearly driven over three pedestrians as your head swiveled to lock on their lock, their burly fingers squeezing the air from the angels on the backs of their denim jackets, which reminds you the million and one secrets exchanged in nearly the last clasp between your father and his brother, during which the hospital's chatter and rattle somehow fell silent in deference to the untranslatable song between them. And just as that clasp endured through what felt like the gradual lengthening of shadows and the emergence of once cocooned things and continues to this day, so too did I float unaware of the 3,000-pound machine in my hands drifting through a stoplight while I gawked at their ceaseless cleave going deeper and deeper still, so that Broad Street from Fairmont to the Parkway reeked of the honey-scented wind pushed from the hummingbirds now hovering above these two men, sweetening somehow the air until nectar, yes, nectar, gathered at the corners of my mouth like sun-colored spittle, the steel vehicle now a lost memory as I join the fire-breasted birds in listening to an air exchange between these two men who are themselves listening forever to the muscled contours of the other's neck, all of us still and listening as if we had nothing to blow up, as if we had nothing to kill. Two black people and a Filipino near the concession stand at the Geraldine R. Dodge Poetry Festival. It wasn't bad the man held back your fries and asked if you'd already paid. It wasn't bad me and you and Nick had just enough money to get us home trying to buy for the three of us one large lemonade. No ice with two extra cups. And it wasn't bad a drink cost one half of what each of us had that day and one tenth of everything we owned. No, we conferred beside the food stand about our lack of bank. When a woman in the Eddie Bauer vest asked, "Are you in line?" You shook your head, "No," and she said, "Thank God I didn't want to be killed or anything." How long the pause before we realized we didn't all hear the same thing wrong? How long then before the three of us burst into laughter from disbelief, almost fallen forward, rolling in Jersey dirt till our guts knotted like a ha ha ha, oh damn goddamn giddy rot let loose in our bellies? How long, Dunny? The next time some mother asks if you already paid, you can tell him over and over for 400 years. You can tell him you got a wife and four kids and you write poems. Matter of fact, you can tell him, "Man, give me that side of fries, two Cokes for my friends, plus 41 acres and a mule." That was Patrick Rizal. And, we're listening to some Bill Evans. box of cigars. I tried either one or two, but when they were stale and broke like sticks or crumbled when I rolled them, and lighting a match was useless, nor could I put them back in the refrigerator. It was too late for that. Even licking them filled my mouth with a ground-up outer leaf product of Lancaster or Eastern Virginia. So schooled I am with cigars. It comes in the blood. And I threw handfuls of them into the street from three floors up. And to my horror, sitting on my stoop were four or five street people who ran to catch them as if they were suddenly rich. And I apologized for that. No one should be degraded that way. My hands were crazy. And I ran down to explain, but they were smoking already. Nor did I have anything to give them since we were living on beans ourselves. I sat and smoked too. And once in a while, we looked up at the window, the open window, and one of us spit into his empty can. We were visionaries. That was Bill Evans, live at the Village Vanguard. And before that, you heard one of the American sonnets by Gerald Stern, who's the teacher of both Patrick Rizal and Ross Gay. So there's a nice little trio of poems there. We'll have, as I said, Patrick Rizal and Ross Gay back here next year in the spring and April for WordFest 2. The book that poem by Rizal came from is called My American Kundiman, and it's a Persia Books and publication, and Against Which by Ross Gay, Covent Garden Press, both of those top-notch books. Well, I have a guest today who's going to also, in the spirit of the afternoon, read poems and play some music for us. Let's maybe hear the poems first and then do the music. Abby Wendell is here. She is a new member of the Maine team and is interested and will be soon joining WPVM as a DJ. How you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing very well. It's good to have you.
Thanks.
So you got some music for us?
I do. I want to play one of the songs on that album, Paul Simon Collection,
yep,
after I read this poem by Pablo Neruda.
Okay.
Because I find the two to be linked,
okay,
even though they're years apart.
Great.
This poem is called A Fable of the Mermaid and the Drunks.
Before you start, what
yes?
cut is it?
17.
All right.
That's for the listeners, too. Fable of the Mermaid and the Drunks. All these fellows were there inside when she entered, utterly naked. They'd been drinking and began to spit at her. Recently come from the river, she understood nothing. She was a mermaid who had lost her way. The taunts flowed over her glistening flesh. Obscenities drenched her golden breasts. A stranger to tears, she did not weep. A stranger to clothes, she did not dress. They pocked her with cigarette ends and with burnt corks, and rolled on the tavern floor in raucous laughter. She did not speak, since speech was unknown to her. Her eyes were the color of faraway love. Her arms were matching topazes. Her lips moved soundlessly in coral light, and ultimately she left by that door. Hardly had she entered the river than she was cleansed, gleaming once more like a white stone in the rain, and without a backward look, she swam once more, swam towards nothingness, swam to her dying.
Oh, October 6, 1960, I was wearing my brown suit, preparing to leave the house of dear. Shook some hands, then adios, Brooklyn amigos. Maybe some of the mad hopes have seen me again. Some even said that my judge, Judge Darryl Culkin, wouldn't play it by the book, maybe let us off the hook. But whoa, afraid to leave the project, to cross into another neighborhood. The Blancos and the nigger gangs, well, they'd kill you if they could.
Angel of mercy, people are suffering all. Children are taught on their knees to believe. Angel of mercy, people are suffering all over the island tonight. Mothers weep, sisters grieve.
Well, I entered the courtroom, stayed in New York County. Just some spick they scrubbed off the sidewalk. Guilty by my dress, guilty in the press. Let the Cape Man burn for the murders. Well, the Spanish boys had their day in court, and now it was time for some law and order. The electric chair for the greasy pair, said the judge to the court reporter. Afraid to leave the project, to cross into another neighborhood. The newspapers and the TV crews, well, they'd kill you if they could.
Angel of mercy, people are suffering all over the world. A Spanish boy could be killed every night of the week.
Just let some white boy die and the world goes crazy for blood. Latin blood. I don't lie when I speak. Well, they shackle of Spanish Harlem, calling old friends on the corners just to lay our prayers upon them, crying adios, hermanos, adios, adios, hermanos, adios.
You're listening to Wordplay, and my guest today is Abby Wendell. She's also helping me out with some promos and community bulletins. Abby, you came in with a real sense of what you wanted to do here with these poems. Tell me about it a little bit. And you just mentioned something that happened out in Woodfin.
On Tuesday in the morning at a plant called Mills Manufacturing Company, which produces parachutes for military personnel, they arrested 59 workers from that manufacturing company, and they were arrested on charges of immigration violations. Whether or not they were illegal immigrants is still up for debate. We'll see what happens, but that's what they were arrested for. And, you know, regardless of the politics of that situation, I think that the poem, Pablo Neruda's poem, speaks to how we treat and understand difference. Mm. And, you know, the mermaid walks into the bar at this point, and Neruda says that she understands nothing, but in fact, she understands enough that she's kind of in the wrong place. She's, you know, a fish out of water. Mm. And she knows enough to go back where she came from, back into her natural environment where she can be herself. And the drunks are sort of the ones that miss out on an opportunity to get to know a majestic, beautiful creature, because their first inclination is to mistreat her and to torture her even.
Yeah, it's what a fable. And so the I haven't heard that Paul Simon tune in a long time. Tell me about the connection there. I mean, it's, I think it's pretty clear, but tell me kind of where those two, over so such a long time, where these two connect for you.
Well, Paul Simon's song speaks about you know, the Mexicans living in Spanish Harlem. And even in Asheville, we associate certain people with certain places in our city. The your ethnicity or your race defines, to a certain extent, your geographic home, where you're gonna spend most of your time in that city. And we rarely branch out, and we rarely enter those different areas of our community, even in Asheville, which proclaims to be, you know, a really integrated and diverse, appreciating diversity town, which I think that it does, but I think color lines are clearly drawn all across the United States.
Oh, and here in this town as well. I mean, just mm-hmm. in the last week's Mountain Express, a lot of talk over the big master plan. I think it was Johnny Grant saying, hey, you know, there's so many color lines here. And even within the board that's looking at this, you know, the community board that's looking at this plan, she sees color lines and sees it as, in a lot of ways, a segregated city. And I think it could be seen that way very clearly.
Right, and it's often something that people don't point out. It's something that we don't talk about necessarily, and something that we like to ignore because it's a really difficult subject. Yeah. And I like the ways that poetry and music can address those issues, because they can almost be depoliticized, and we can think about them as human beings beyond the color of our skin or where we're living in that community.
Yeah, it's such a nice coincidence, but the poems that I was reading, I think all three of these poems, and not coincidentally for them, but nicely, a nice coincidence with you, what you're reading, we're looking at situations where people of color or people of different ethnicities or just different ways of being, like the guy watching the two bikers embrace on Broad Street in Philly, or this narrator in Patrick's poem saying, hey, we're black and Filipino, and this white woman is like joking or not joking about us killing them. And, you know, the sense of that there's these places when you're in a city or a town like Asheville where you are forced to deal with each other, and there's some ways that people can do that with openness, and there are ways that people can do that with closeness. And even that last poem about cigars, the narrator is kind of aware that he was being a little insulting to these people down below. It's kind of a class poem.
Yes, although yeah. I liked the fact that he went down and smoked cigars with them.
Yeah,
because I think that's, you know, we all make mistakes,
right.
And we need to be aware of the mistakes we make, and we however, in our awareness, I think we need not to get caught there. We need to realize that, hey, we made a mistake, but we can move beyond that mistake, and people will forgive us.
Yeah, yeah, that sense of, in some ways, political correctness. For, I know why it's the need for awareness of language and certain codes of conduct within the spheres of politics and social life are very important, but they can be a bit of a trap sometimes. And yeah, you make a mistake, or you're awkward, or you're uncomfortable. The best thing to do is just to keep going. You know, we are visionary. We were visionaries is the last line. It's kind of a joking, drunken line, but it's also like, well, actually, maybe it is visionary just to hang out and smoke cigars together. And certainly the two poets that come out of his, you know, and, I mean, they're their own poets, but it's nice to see them taking that idea and really talking about race. You have another poem by Neruda you want to read?
I do have another poem. This one's a little bit longer.
Well, read every sixth word and we can... no, okay, go ahead. Yeah.
Called Ode to the Sea. Here, surrounding the island, there's sea. But what sea? It's always overflowing, says yes, then no, then no again, and no. Says yes in blue, in sea spray, raging. Says no, and no again. It can't be still. It stammers, my name is C. It slaps the rocks, and when they aren't convinced, strokes them and soaks them and smothers them with kisses, with seven green tongues of seven green dogs, or seven green tigers, or seven green seas, beating its chest, stammering its name. O sea, this is your name. O comrade ocean, don't waste time or water getting so upset. Help us instead. We are meager fishermen, men from the shore who are hungry and cold, and you're our foe. Don't beat so hard. Don't shout so loud. Open your green coffers. Place gifts of silver in our hands. Give us this day our daily fish. Here in each house, we all crave it, whether it's of silver, crystal, or moonlight. Spawn for the poor kitchens on earth. Don't hoard it, you miser. Coldly rushing like wet lightning beneath your waves. Come now. Open yourself, and leave it near our hands. Help us, ocean, deep green father, end one day our earthly poverty. Let us harvest your lives' endless plantation, your wheat and eggs, your oxes, your metals, the wet splendor and submerged fruits. Father Sea, we know already what you are called. All the seagulls circulate your name on the beaches. Now, behave yourself. Don't shake your mane. Don't threaten anyone. Don't smash against the sky your beautiful teeth. Ignore for a moment your glorious history. Give to every man, to every woman, and to every child a fish, large or small, every day. Go out to every street in the world and distribute fish, and then scream. Scream so all the working poor could hear you, so they could say, sticking their hands into the mine, "Here comes the old man Sea to distribute fish." And they'll go back down into the darkness, smiling. And on the streets and in the forests, men and the earth will smile on oceanic smile. But if you don't want it, if you don't care for it, then wait. Wait for us. We must worry. First, we must try to solve and straighten out human affairs. The biggest problems first, then all the others. And then we'll enter you. We'll chop the waves with a knife made of fire, on an electric horse leaping over foam. Singing will sink until we touch the bottom of your guts. An atomic thread will guard your shrink. We'll plant your deep garden trees of cement and steel. We'll tie your hands and feet. On your skin, man will walk, spitting, yanking in bunches, building armatures, mounting and taming you to dominate your spirit. All this will occur when us men have straightened out our problem, the big problem. We'll slowly solve everything. We'll force you, sea. We'll force you, earth. Perform miracles. Because in our very selves, in the struggle, is fish, is bread, is the miracle.
Nice. That's Pablo Neruda. And what's the title of the poem again?
It's called Ode to the Sea.
Yeah.
And on Friday night, there was a show on WNCW called Patagonia, Eden at the End of the World. Mm-hmm. It was a National Geographic special, and it was just talking about the degradation of the Pacific Ocean, and how large fishing corporations are fishing for, I forget the name of the fish. You put them on pizza.
Anchovies.
There we go.
I don't put them on pizza.
Well, my dad does. But the overfishing of such kinds of fish causes a reaction all the way up the food chain.
Yeah.
And so a lot of the animals that are endangered on Patagonia is the result of the fishing industry.
Yeah.
And the human desire to kind of eat too much.
Yeah. Well, that's happening obviously all over the world. You have a real political sense of things, and I think a kind of a passion for facing problems and calling things what they are. And so, you talk at first about this event over at Woodfin, and you said we'll see, that kind of sense of a witness or of a citizen witness. You're tell us a little bit about your new job, because I think that there's a connection with what you do at Maine, and also maybe what you're hoping to do here on PVM.
Yeah, there's a new position was created over at the Mountain Area Information Network called the Community Journalism Coordinator. Mm. And I got that job through the AmeriCorps, mm-hmm. actually. So I'm sponsored by the federal government. And
hooray!
Hooray!
It's one of their better programs.
Yes.
Luckily, somehow uncut.
For now.
Yeah.
And I work for the community technologies department of that. So the idea is to bridge the digital divide, and work with poverty, not necessarily in a hands-on kind of way, but in a broader organizational way, because a lot of poverty and a lot of racism is just a part of the way our society works.
Mm-hmm.
It's institutionalized. So the reform needs to come from the institution as mm-hmm. well as within each individual.
Mm-hmm.
And the community journalism program over at Maine is designed to open up the airwaves mm-hmm. to populations in Asheville and Western North Carolina that don't necessarily have a voice on mainstream media.
Mm-hmm.
Part of Maine's business model is to take internet dollars and to use those internet dollars to create an independent media that can encourage an informed citizenry and encourage people to get involved in local politics, because you know, city council is there for us.
Yeah. Yeah.
They make the decisions, but they only make the decisions when we're involved in telling them how to make the decisions,
yeah.
or they could make better decisions if we were more involved in telling them how to make the decisions. So in order to be able to have a voice, I think you have to be informed. You have to have information. So the Community Journalism Project is an attempt to open people's minds.
Yeah. Yeah, people need to be able to know how to bring what they have to the table and to be invited to the table, it sounds like, you know, and it sounds like a great job, and I'm glad you're doing it, and it's exciting. Maine is, I love what they do. We had a nice connection with them. When I say we, I mean Laura Hopekill and Glennis Redmond and Jeff and a bunch of people with the WordFest, and we talk about kind of citizens journalism, and I think for me, hearing you talk, I mean, just on its own, it's important. But if I'm trying to make a connection to it with poetry and Neruda in particular, I think of Neruda's he's really famous for his odes, for the kind of, you know, not ode to a Grecian urn, that's a great poem, but ode to like a fish, ode to a cup, you know, a sense of his love for the basic, the common, the kind of earthy, sense of things being, and that poem that you just read, the long poem, a kind of ode to the working people, that is, I think, what a poet can do. I think when people want to say poetry doesn't do much, I think of a poet like Neruda or other poets who, or like Lorca, who I hope to read today, who whole populations know that work in their heart and know it because it speaks to them or sings them or praises them. And I feel like citizens journalism, or being a witness as a poet or as a activist, is essential. And I see you doing it at all these different levels, so it's exciting to see.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I also wanted to say one other thing about that poem. You mentioned the voice of the working man.
Yeah.
And that's obviously, that was a strong theme in Neruda's work, all of his poetry. And in this poem in particular, there's a shift towards the end of the poem, mm-hmm. where it moves away from being a fisherman and asking for our daily fish, which is a very human, a very natural, all animals kind of ask nature to provide for them.
Yeah.
But it moves into the second part where it says, you know, if you're going to continue to be so difficult, we're going to use our cunning and we're going to figure out how to dominate you.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll take advantage mm-hmm. of your offerings, and we'll give ourselves more. We'll take control of nature, almost outsmart nature.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of see a relationship between that and what a lot of industry does.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, you know, it's the, whenever you think about money first, you know, what falls, the natural systems are ignored, and then we start to see what happens. We don't see it for a long time because there's so much there, so much abundance, but that abundance is, we're seeing the end of it right now, and or the vision of the end.
On a more hopeful note, there are a lot of programs in Asheville, a lot of schools, a lot of community gardens that are trying to get children to work with their hands in the soil again, to understand that food doesn't come from the grocery store, but it comes from the earth.
Yeah.
And it takes a whole lot of work. And with that work comes a certain humbleness, humility, that's the right word. And
they both are good.
And appreciation for what the earth provides for us. Whereas if it comes, you know, broccoli in a cellophane wrapper, there isn't that connection there. There isn't that almost, you know, spiritual relationship with the world around us.
Yeah. So true. Well, I'm speaking with Abby Wendell, and you're listening to WPVM, and we're going to take a quick break and listen to some music and then come back, and hopefully, Abby, you'll join me in reading some more poems.
I would love to.
All right. And I'm going to leave you with some Jimmy Smith right now. You're listening to WPVM 103.5, the Progressive Voice of the Mountains.
Thank you.
Are you looking to move? Have friends that are? Check out Maine's community listing agent, HomeSearch, on the Maine webpage. HomeSearch is a local guide to apartments, shared housing, sublets, vacation rental, and real estate. Detailed listings with maps available at a mouse click. Just go to maine.nc.us/HomeSearch, or it's all one word, HomeSearch, or follow the link from the homepage at maine.nc.us. Jimmy Smith's The Sermon. You're listening to Wordplay on this beautiful Sunday afternoon. WPVM 103.5. Next week, I think next week on Sunday, we'll have Glennis Redmond in, whose new book, Under the Sun, from Main Street Rag, is coming out. She will be reading at the 29th, I'm pretty sure, at Malaprop's at 7 o'clock. Double-check those dates and times, but she'll be, I think, long-awaited second book, and I think it'll be a great, I know it'll be a great reading, so check that out. Mark Strand will be coming town, the poet Mark Strand, in September sometime for Barnes & Noble, and he'll be doing a reading that will partly benefit some of the River District, and I'm not sure, I'll know more about that next week. A lot of good things going on. Obviously, the UNCA and Warren Wilson have readings coming up this semester, and so many different things going on. I know that David Byrne's coming into town. Abby, anything off the top of your head?
Not in terms of readings,
okay.
No.
Okay, well, just stay tuned. We're going to finish the show today with some trading fours, reading poems back and forth, and Abby's going to start with a Langston Hughes poem.
This one's called Fulfillment. The earth meaning, like the sky meaning, was fulfilled. We got up and went to the river, touched silver water, laughed and bathed in the sunshine. Day became a bright ball of light for us to play with. Sunset, a yellow curtain. Night, a velvet screen. The moon, like an old grandmother, blessed us with a kiss, and sleep took us both in, laughing.
It's about the ponies. This is a poem by Gary Lilly. It's about the ponies. I'm at the racetrack with Zoot, and we're both drinking coffee now because the bourbon has us down, and he doesn't like how I bet, so I make the run and buy us two grande styrofoam cups. I take the long shots black with sugar. He reads the racing forms and tracks how the local ponies ran the past four Fridays at Pimlico. He contends good horses only lose when the jockeys stop whipping them, so he digs slap-happy drivers and always checks to see who's holding the reins. And I say, I like my horses smiling. Plus, he's wearing his racetrack clothes, a slick-as-damn blue pinstripe suit, and his T.O.'s gray fedora that he stole while paying respect at the wake. got on a pair of one size too small, highly glossed blue alligator knobs he found in a thrift shop in New Orleans. He puts the polish on himself because he's too tight-fisted to pay someone else to shine them. And here I am in black Wrangler jeans, a cotton shirt with holes in the sleeves, looking all the day sucker, but $100 to the good. It's obvious he doesn't like my smile, and when I try to make small talk, he says, if I can't shut my mouth, I might as well just change my seat. You'd think I'd said something bad about John Coltrane, who's on a gold medallion dangling off his neck like it's some type of racetrack crucifix. He's chewed down to the last 3 inches of his Cuban cigar, his left eye half closed in the stogie smoke that creeps up the side of his face. He's a man of bad habits, and he's as mad as the first wife of a bigamist because I've won more money than him. He's a riot, sipping his black coffee quiet while keeping his half eye off me, and that's the look that has me worried, because he might not drive me home on account of my gambling approach lacking horse logic or player sense. He gets pissed when he discovers I'm a sorry ass who can't remember the damn horse's name, and his good eye slams shut in disgust. The cigar stub glows on one side of the mouth while he spits from the other, telling me that I'd won the money in the third race with El Diablo on the ride, just whipping the hell out of Lucky's Paradise.
This one's entitled Poem by Frank O'Hara. The eager note on my door said, call me when you get in. So I quickly threw a few tangerines into my overnight bag, straightened my eyelids and shoulders, and headed straight for the door. It was autumn by the time I got around the corner, oh, all unwilling to be either pertinent or bemused, but the leaves were brighter than grass on the sidewalk. Funny, I thought, that the lights are on this late and the hall door open. Still up at this hour, a champion highlight player like himself? Oh, fie, for shame! What a host, so zealous! And he was there in the hall, flat on a sheet of blood that ran down the stairs. I did appreciate it. There are few hosts who so thoroughly prepare to greet a guest, only casually invited, and that several months ago.
I love that poem. One last poem. This is by a poet named Chase Twitchell, and it's called Marijuana. Stoned by noon, I'd take the trail that runs along the X River in the state of Y, summer of 69, crows black ruckus overhead. I'd wade through the fern's sound of vanishing to the almost invisible ledge, stark basin canted out to the southwest, sheltered, good drainage, full moon, remote, state land. You could smell the blacker foreign green from a long way off when it rained, incense-grade floral, the ripening spoils, then pang of wood smoke, antiseptic pitch and balsam scents cut like initials into a beach, then cold that kills the world for a while, puts it under, then wakes it up again in spring when it's still tired. I woke from its anesthetic, wanting the tight buds of my loneliness to swell and split, not die in waiting. It was why I rushed through everything, why I tore away at the perpetual gauze between me and the stinging world, its starlight and resins, new muscle married to smoke and tar, just wedding the world for a while. About to divorce it, too, to marry some other smoke and tar. On snowshoes and falling snow, we lugged peat, manure, and greensand a mile up there. Alfalfa meal, spent hops, the clones bronzed, hairy, and sticky, and a week before frost we'd slice the dirt around them with a bread knife, which gave the dope a little extra turpentine. Weed, reefer, smoke, it was one of life's perfumes. Sometimes its flower opens on a city street, gray petals, phantom musk dispersing. Sleeping out on the high ledges on a bed of blueberries dwarfed by wind and springy beneath the blankets, we'd watch for meteors and talk till dawn, gazing toward the pinnacle in the distance, pyramid to the everlasting glory of never enough. Not far below us, in his tomb, asleep in the granite chill with the bones of his faithful animals. Could this be the pinnacle? To be slumming back there, buoyant on the same old wave, just breaking, now the wave of words, the liftoff? I'm still cracking open the robin's egg to see the little heart, the glue. A pinnacle is a fulcrum, a scale. And now that it's tipped, I can look back through the ghost of self-consciousness to its embryo, first the tomboy, then the chick in a deerskin skirt, the first breaking of the spirit, the heart's deflowerment. Caw, caw, a crow wants to peck at the ember of the mind as it was before it tasted the dark meat of the world. But I can call it back. The match's sulfur spurt, its petals of carbon and tar, a flash of mind, a memory, how after deflowerment, each deflowerment, I became the flower. All right. That's from a book called Dog Language, Chase Twitchell. We heard from Alpha Zulu, Gary Copeland Lilly, Asheville's own. Some Frank O'Hara from his new Selected that came out. Obviously, he's been long gone, but it's a beautiful way to read Frank O'Hara, unlike the big Collected that's so hard to read and so hard to figure out which poem is which. Some Langston Hughes from Selected Poems, paperback. And we're gonna listen to some music that Avi brought, and maybe read one more poem if there's time. You're listening to Wordplay. This is Sebastian Matthews, and Wendy Abel is my guest today. Tell us about the music. And
this is from a band called the Aliens. They are originally from Ecuador, Key West, Floyd, Virginia, and they're in Asheville at the moment. And it's off their first album called Sons of Survivors, and the song is called Work.
I got to see you.
was The Aliens doing Work. And here's the last poem. It's by Major Jackson, fitting the theme, Blunts. The first time I got high, I stood in a circle of boys at 23rd and Ridge, tucked inside a doorway that smelled of piss. It was March. The cold rains all but blurred our sight as we feigned sophistication, passing a bullet-shaped bottle of malt. Johnny Cash had a love for transcendental numbers and explained between puffs resembling little gasps of air the link to all creation was the mathematician. Malik, the smartest of the crew, counter-argued and cited the holy life of prayer as a gateway to the Islamic faith that was for all intents the true path for the righteous black man. No one disputed. Malik cocked his head, pinched the joint, and pulled so hard we imagined his lips crazy glued into stiff O's. It was long agreed that Lefty would inherit his father's used car business, thus destined for a life of wrecks. Then, amid a fit of coughing, I broke the silence. I want to be a poet. It was nearing dinner time. Jesus lived here. His sister was yelling at their siblings over the evening news and game shows. The stench of hot dogs and sauerkraut drifted down the dank hallway. Pre-spring wind flapped the plastic covering of a junk man's shopping cart as Eddie Hardwick licked left to right the thin strip of glue at the edge of a rolling paper, then uttered, "So, you want the tongue of God." I bent double in the blade of smoke and looked up for help. It was too late. We were tragically hip. You're listening to Wordplay. This is Sebastian Matthews, and I'm moving out of here. See you next week.